may seem like just a trite saying, but it's not, that all is vain unless the Spirit of the Holy One comes down. Sometimes when we feel the most prepared, we feel the least amount of liberty. Sometimes when we're the least prepared, we feel the most amount of liberty. To teach us that it's all by God's grace and by His Spirit that we're allowed to say anything good in His name. So I feel the need of your prayers. And if you have your Bibles, turn to Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1. If I were to rename the book of Hebrews, which I won't try to do, but if I were to try to do that, I might try to call it Jesus versus Creation. Jesus versus Creation. When you first hear those words, you think, that's a big mismatch. You certainly stack the deck in favor of one. Obviously, Jesus is spotless, and Jesus is wonderful, and Jesus is all-knowing, and He's omniscient, and omnipresent. And creation is sin-cursed, and there's problems and frailties and all kinds of bad things that we see here in creation. Surely this is a big mismatch. But let's look a little closer. The book of Hebrews was written to Christians. Christians who had converted from Judaism into following Jesus Christ while He was here walking upon this earth. They had longed for the Messiah. They had looked for the Messiah. And then the Messiah had come. And while many of their brethren didn't recognize the Messiah, they recognized Him to be the true Holy One sent from Israel. People like the old man and the old woman who, when He was brought into the temple, they recognized Him and knew that this truly was the Christ. But now Christ has gone back to heaven. And it has been some years since He's gone back to heaven. And the scoffers are saying, where is the promise of His coming? And He's not coming back yet. When Jesus Christ left, He said, I will return. I will come again. But He has not yet returned. And the days have lengthened since He has promised to return. Not only that, but they're also beginning to feel ostracization and persecution at the hands of not just some big bad enemy, but at the hands of their own countrymen, of their own fellows, of their own family, of their own kin. Because they have claimed that this Jesus is the true Messiah, and they have forsaken the old covenant, forsaken the old way, and begun to follow the true and living God. Now, we know very little about persecution, don't we? But just try to put yourself in their shoes for a minute. Imagine that you, for 30 years, have lived in the same community, and that you've gone to the same grocery store every Friday morning for 30 years. And you know the grocer like he's one of your family. You always walk in, and you say hello, and you inquire about the family, he inquires about yours. You ask how the week's been, and he tells you, and you always tell him about your week. And you share your birthdays and your fun times and your bad times, and just a good old friend. And then one day you walk into the grocery store and see the grocer, and at first he doesn't say anything to you. You think, well, that's a little odd, but maybe he's busy. And then he walks over to you and says, I'm sorry, we don't serve your kind. Now, I don't know that ever happened, but imagine something like that happening. And imagine the pain that you would feel in your heart. Imagine the struggles you would feel within your soul. Well, there's something like that is exactly what these Hebrew people faced. Or maybe even go to a family dinner, and one member of the family would refuse to sit with you at dinner because you're a Christian. You're following this imposter, this infidel, Jesus Christ, and they want nothing to do with Him. Imagine that. That would be tough, wouldn't it? And just as you and I probably would, some of these people, these true Christians, began to waver in their faith. And they began to think, wow, isn't there something better than this? We follow this one named Jesus. He's gone away. He hasn't returned. And all we have felt in the interim has been trouble and trials and loss of friendship. Much more pain than we ever had before. I don't know. Isn't there something better than this? So some of them would begin to say, well, we still believe that Jesus is truly the Christ. And we're still going to follow Him. We're going to keep it kind of undercover. Kind of under the cover of darkness. And so that we don't seem to be any too different from anybody else out there. Now, what does this apply to you and me? You and I probably have never faced any persecution for our faith. Being a Christian is well accepted in the United States of America. Most people, or the majority of people, claim to be Christians. Does this have any applicability to us tonight? It's not persecution that we sometimes struggle with. Much of what we struggle with is the allure of something else that seems better, that seems to be more appealing, that is more easily grabbed a hold of than a close fellowship, a close walk, a serious walk with Jesus Christ. And so we also waver at times in our devotion to Him. And so I love how God, through this writer, attacks this problem here in the book of Hebrews. He says, I'm going to set up for you, not badgering you, but I'm going to set up for you a series of comparisons. And he compares Jesus to the angels, when some were enamored with the angels. And he compares Jesus to Moses, and compares Jesus to Abraham, and compares Jesus to creation, and compares Jesus to the old way of doing things, the old covenant. And says, now, you decide. You decide. Which one is more alluring? Which one has more appeal? Which one deserves your attention? Which one deserves your devotion? Which one deserves your admiration and all of you? You see, he told us that we must love the Lord our God with all of our heart and all of our soul and all of our mind and all of our strength. But I love, again, how he does it. Recently, Rachel was going to the store, and so Sophia and Scarlett and I were playing Chutes and Ladders. It's a very silly little game. There's a course that you go on. There's numbers between 1 and 100. And you spin the wheel, and whatever you spin the wheel to, you get to go that many spaces. And if you land at the bottom of a ladder, you get to go all the way up to the top of the ladder, wherever it takes you. But if you land at the top of a chute, you get to go all the way down the chute, wherever that takes you. And we've been playing this game for way too long, and Sophia was behind the whole game. She was way behind. She could not buy a break. Every time she would get a little far, she'd fall down a chute. And Scarlett was ahead the whole time. But then Sophia landed on number 28. Number 28, if I'm not mistaken, is the big ladder. It takes you all the way up to number 84, which is only 16 away from 100. And she got up there. And now she was way ahead of Scarlett. And here's what she said. She said, ha, 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 Scarlett. Now look who's ahead. I'm ahead of you. I'm going to win. And so my best daddy, I said, Sophia, don't say that. I said, Sophia, because if you say that, next time you might spin a two and land on the chute and go all the way back down. Then I thought about it. And I said, that's not the right reason for her to not do that. I said, Sophia, wait a minute. I said, don't do that because it's not right to tease your sister. And I love that about how God approaches Hebrews. You know, God could just say, you better serve me, you better love me, just because it's right. And you know what? That would be good enough, wouldn't it? Or He could say, you better love me, you better serve me, you better give me your all, or else you're going to fall down the chute. And there are warnings here in this book. He says, how shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation? But that's not how He sets it up. The way He sets it up is, first of all, He says, let me show you Jesus. And when I show you the beauty and the glory of Jesus, you won't be able to help. If you really have a heart for me, you will not be able to help but switch all your allegiance away from whatever else in life. You see, some people say, well, I'm not, some people are enamored with work, some people are enamored with success, some people are enamored with all kinds of things. And some people are enamored with nothing. Some people are just lazy. But you know what? Even laziness is being enamored with something. Laziness is something. He says, so whatever you're enamored with, when I show you Jesus Christ, when I show you His beauty and His glory, that you will not be able to help but switch your allegiance from all those things to Jesus Christ. And here's how He does it. God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by His Son. The first thing that God tells us here in His book, He's speaking to maybe people like you, maybe you're not, maybe you're strong in your faith today. I say, praise the Lord, this will strengthen your faith tonight if you see Jesus Christ. But maybe you are wavering like these Hebrews were. And the first thing that He tells them, He says, listen, God has spoken. God speaks. He communicates to people. He communicates to us. You know, God is under no obligation whatsoever to tell us anything of Himself, to reveal Himself at all. But He has chosen in His good pleasure to reveal Himself to man. Isn't that wonderful? And in the old days, before Christ came, He revealed Himself in many different ways, through types and through shadows, through the prophets. He would give them a word and they would come and they would speak that word. And then And in the midst of these speakings in different ways, He would reveal Himself in small glimpses and small flashes. But never did we see the complete revelation of who God was until it says, but in these last days. You know, sometimes we think of the last days as being the evil days, don't we? We see the last days and we think, that's the time when things are going to wax worse and worse. That's the time when evil is going to increase and good is going to be put down and the love of many are going to wax cold. But in this book He says, the last days are the good days. The last days are the days when Christ has come and we live under the revelation of Jesus Christ. And we see all of what God wants us to know about Himself. We see that because we have the truth and the gospel of Jesus Christ. He says the last days are our day to be... The prophets long to see the things. The angels long to see things that we now see. This is a great time. We live in the day of Jesus Christ. He has come. But He says, God who used to speak this way, now speaks to us by His Son. In 2 Chronicles chapter 6, Solomon is speaking here and he is amazed. They are dedicating the temple that they have built to the worship of God. And Solomon says these words in utter amazement. In verse 18, he says, but will God in very deed dwell with men on the earth? Behold, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain thee. How much less this house which I have built? He says, could it truly be possible that God would come and dwell with men on earth? He says, heaven can't contain God. The heavens of heavens can't contain God. Much less this house that I've built. And you know what Solomon is so amazed at? Solomon is not amazed that God's going to come in flesh and dwell. He's amazed that God's going to allow His felt presence to be in the house, and that God will come to be worshipped in this house. That's much less. It's wonderful, but it's much less than God actually coming in flesh and dwelling in the house. You know, the psalmist writes, we should never be amazed that God has come and spoken to us through His Son. We should never be amazed that God would send His Son to earth. The psalmist writes in Psalm 113, never forget this. Never forget this principle. It says, He humbles Himself to behold the things that are in heaven and in the earth. The second one doesn't shock us at all, does it? The second one makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Of course He humbles Himself to behold the things that are in earth. We're sinful people. Bad things happen in earth. I'm kind of embarrassed sometimes to see what happens even in my own city. Bad things happen in earth. But that's not all it says. It says, God humbles Himself to behold the things that are in heaven. Heaven is His throne room. Heaven is a place where no sin, no sorrow, no problems are in heaven. And yet God is so much higher than even heaven. Is it a condescend to even behold the things that are in heaven? Now, couple that together with the fact that God has said, I will come through my Son. And God has spoken to you today through His Son. You see, the prophets were wonderful. We learn a lot from the prophets. We should pay attention to the prophets. They were wonderful. But the prophets can only do this. They can only say, let me tell you what He said. The Son can say, let me tell you what I know. If I want to know something about Mark Jones, I might ask his neighbor, right? And they would say, yes, he usually comes in, leaves for work at 7 o'clock, and he usually gets home at 5 o'clock, and he usually goes to church on Sundays, and he's gone all day, and he comes home, and he's got a family. I think they have some children. I'm not sure how many they have, and they're kind of young. And you can learn a little bit about Mark Jones by asking his neighbor, I'm sure. But if I really want to know about Mark Jones, I would ask Nathan Jones, wouldn't I? Because Nathan lives with Mark Jones, and he dwells with him. And he knows about him when he's in a good mood, and knows about him when he's in a bad mood. He knows the real Mark Jones. The same way with the Son of God. Jesus Christ has spoken. God has spoken to us through His Son, who can speak with authority. And Jesus says in John 15, verse 15, that all that the Father hath told me have I revealed unto you. He says, I have come with everything that you need to know about God. Whatever you need to know about God, He says, I am speaking to you through my Son. And not only has God spoken unto us by His Son. But even better than that, the Son is the message. The Son is the message. He said, let me tell you about God. And the Son says, but what I really want to tell you about is this is God. This is the message. This is the good news. Jesus Christ is the gospel. The gospel is a word we use a lot. But what is the gospel? The gospel is good news. And what is the good news? The good news is Jesus Christ. God has come in flesh and dwelt among men. Oh, what a powerful thing that God has spoken unto us through His Son. And then He lists here in these first three verses, He lists seven things. Seven glorious attributes of Christ that make Him superior to all else. No matter what else you're going to throw up against it, creation, life, your family, your job, whatever it may be, whatever you're enamored with tonight, whatever you spend your time, whatever you give your allegiance, He says, compare them to this. We won't try to go through all seven. We may try to hit about four. I want us tonight to see the beauty of Jesus Christ. The first thing He says, He has, verse 2, He has spoken unto us by His Son, whom He hath appointed the heir of all things. Jesus Christ, this is the figure of the God-man, Jesus Christ, as God Himself, He already owned all things. He already was the possessor of all things because He was God. But speaking as in Him as His mediator role of God-man, He says He has been appointed the heir of all things. Whatever dominion, whatever possessions that God has, Jesus Christ is the heir, received all of these things because He has been appointed the heir by what He will voluntarily do by coming down to earth. Now, that may not mean too much to you. Sometimes, I shouldn't tell you, but sometimes Rachel and I joke around, just joking, I promise. My parents are not wealthy by any means. And when you divide 12 by not very much, you get a whole lot of not very much. And her parents are not wealthy by any means. And so sometimes we say, you know, I just married you for your parents' money. But that's silly, right? But when God, when it says that Jesus Christ has been appointed the heir of all things, that's saying a lot. Romans 11 says, for of Him and to Him and through Him are all things. And we know that He owns all things. He has he's the heir of all things. He owns all the material world. But also not just the material world, not only just the gold and the silver and the mountains and the oceans and all these things and the galaxies. Not only is He the inheritor of all these things, but also, my friends, to Him are all things. Even the unfolding of history is all done for Jesus Christ. All done for the glory of Jesus Christ. You know, men don't like to think that, do they? Alexander the Great. I think there's a movie about him out right now. I heard it's getting really bad reviews, really bad ratings. Nobody's going to see it. Oh well. He was a man among men, the greatest man of the time, the greatest conqueror who had ever lived. He was brutal. He was vicious. He was furious. And he went through great regions, amazing places he went to the span that he conquered in his short time here on earth. He died as a young man, but he conquered far, vast regions. Why? Because he was ambitious. Because he was greedy. Because he was full of himself. But ultimately, why? So that he could spread the language of Greek to all the known world. And that the Bible, the good news, might be spread also in that common language that all men had, the language of Greek. You see, for of Him and to Him are all things. All the unfolding of history is for Him. Caesar was feeling the need for some money, wasn't he? Caesar Augustus. He said, I need some money. So he said, it's time for a tax. And he calls for a tax on all the land. Why did Caesar do that? Because he needed some money. He wanted some money. But ultimately, why did Caesar call for the tax? Because in Micah it says, behold, out of Bethlehem of Ephrathah shall he be born who will... And it goes on to speak of Jesus Christ. And so Joseph had to go back to his native city to pay his tax, didn't he? And Jesus Christ will be born of a virgin in exactly the place that Micah had prophesied many years before. You see, all of history is to Him. Now, let me ask you, don't you want to be a friend of one? Don't you want to be a close companion of one that is the inheritor, the heir of all things, both macro, both micro, both material, both physical, both everything to Him. He's the heir of all things. And then it tells us, by whom also He made the worlds. Jesus Christ is the Creator. What does this tell us? How does this establish Christ as being superior over everything else? Well, only God can create. This establishes His divinity, this establishes His deity. Only God can create anything, much less all things. So He is divine. Not only is God, not only is the Son the heir of all things, but also, guess what? He's God. He's God. Shouldn't you listen to God? Shouldn't you want to be a friend of God? Absolutely, we would say, yes, we want to be a friend of God. He's God. But also His creation of the world establishes, without a doubt, establishes His brilliance as a designer. We see the beauty of creation and we're amazed. But sometimes we forget just how brilliant that Christ is as a designer. And so sometimes small little things will grab our attention, and again we have to say, wow, God, You're excellent. And I remember reading just this last couple weeks ago about the tsunami. And I don't know how true all of this is, but apparently they say that although hundreds of thousands of people were killed, the number of animals is astonishing in the very smallness of the number of animals that have been killed. You see, what happened was the animals sensed this turbulence coming. And they took off in the other direction, ran for the hills, ran away from the coming danger. The humans, with our increased minds, our advanced minds, we had no idea. We sat out there sunbathing and we were taken away. And the animals ran away and they were safe. Now listen, God gave humans dominion over the animals. God gave humans much greater minds than the animals. He gave us the ability to reason, to think about danger, to get away from danger. What did He give to the angels? What did He give to the animals who can't even think at all? He gave them a sense to get away from danger. You think about that and you say, wow. You know, that's exactly what it's designed to do. Psalm 8, which is describing the creation, it says, when I think of all these things, I say what? How excellent. How excellent is Thy name in all the earth. When you see the beauty, the wisdom, the brilliance of the designer, you say, how excellent, how wonderful You are, O Christ. Thirdly, the creation of the world establishes Christ as superior over all creation. That Psalm 8 also says this. It says, when I consider the heavens, the works of Thy fingers, the moon and the stars, which Thou hast ordained. What do you say? You say, what is man? What am I that Thou art mindful of him? And the Son of Man, that Thou visitest him. You consider all these things. You say, and where do I fit into this picture? And not only to know that, but to know that every hair of my head is numbered. Yes. And to know that He knows my downsittings, and knows my uprisings, and He knows my thoughts from afar off. He knows all these things. And it says, even of Him, that I can cast my cares upon Him, for He careth for me. And we say, what? God, You're greater than I am. And I love You. And I want to serve You. Don't you love the way the writer of the Hebrews does this? Don't you love the way that when you're wavering in your faith and you're not sure if the journey is really worth it all anyway, and you're just not sure if all these troubles and all these trials that you've experienced as being a Christian are really going to pan out in the end, all you have to do is be shown a vision of Christ, and you're right back on center, right back on track, right back ready to keep on traveling on. He has been appointed the heir of all things, by whom also He made the worlds. Number three, who being the brightness of His glory. Think about the Son, not the Son of God, but the Son of creation. When you look at the Son, what do you think about? Think, wow, that is really bright. Don't you? You see, you cannot separate the sun from its brightness, can you? They're distinct. They're not the same thing. But you really can't separate the sun from its brightness, can you? The sun is made up of, I don't know, chemicals and gases and all these things. the planet. I don't know what it all is made up of, but when I see the sun, I see the brightness of the sun. The brightness of the sun is the glory of the sun. We're amazed by how the sun can keep us warm all the time, just warm enough all the time. We're amazed at the sun. It's bright. It's glorious. Says of Jesus Christ, He is the brightness of the glory of God. What does glory mean? Glory means value, worth. Do you want to see the worth of God? Do you wonder about the value of God? He says, look on my Son, and you'll see the brightness, the expression, the shining forth of the glory of God. We sing this song tonight, The Love of God. I love the third verse. We all love it. Where the writer attempts to describe the love of God, and you can almost feel in his words how helpless as he or she writes. When he says, could we with ink the ocean fill, if all the waters were full of ink, and were the skies of parchment made, were every stalk on earth a quill, and every man a scribe by trade, to write the love of God above would drain the ocean dry, nor could the scroll contain the whole, though stretched from sky to sky. And Ephesians would tell us that, you know what, that doesn't overdo it at all. He said in Ephesians, it says that he wants you to know the height and the breadth and the depth and all these things, and to know the love of Christ which passeth all knowledge. In other words, he's saying you cannot overstate the love of God. Even if you did have the oceans, they would be drained dry. Even if you did have every blade of grass as a pen, it would not be enough. Because you're not overstating the case when you talk about the love of God in those kind of terms. It's unspeakable. It's too much. It's unsearchable. But you know what? The love of God is only one small, it's not small, it's only one attribute of God. All of these things, His love, His wrath, all these things go into His glory, His value, His worth. You see, my friends, to see the glory of God would absolutely cause us to combust. It would burst our heads. As we know the story so well of Moses, when he desired to see the glory of God, and God says, Moses, I'm sorry, you just can't see my glory. It was a noble question, wasn't it? A noble desire, wasn't it, to see the glory of God? He says, I'm sorry, you cannot see my glory. Why? Because it would bust us. It was too much for them. It would consume us. We were to see the glory of God. So Moses leaves there, and even the reflection upon Moses' face of seeing the hinder parts of God, sheltered by the cliffs of the rock, was enough to blind the eyes of all the people that saw Moses' face. You see, you can't see it. But he says, this is my beloved Son. Hear ye Him. If you want to see my value, if you want to see my worth, look at my Son. He's excellent. The excellency of the excellency. Who being the brightness of His glory, and we'll go through one more, and the express image of His person. The express image of His person. Maybe you have a stamp at home. I tried this with my children. They didn't understand it at all, but we'll try it with you tonight. If you have a stamp at home that has your name and address, you look at that stamp up, you turn it over, look at it, you can't read anything, it's backwards, it's hard to read, you can't really see it. You press that stamp into some ink and you put it onto the paper and you read Isaac Guess, 815 Avery, Memphis, Tennessee, 38122. The stamp on the paper says exactly what I wanted to say. It's the exact same image as what is on the stamp. Now, sometimes when I do this stamp, I push too hard on the left side, I push too hard on the right side, and it comes off kind of blurred on one side or the other. It never comes out perfect. Jesus Christ, it says, is the express image of the Father. You know, we have to be careful about this, just like we have to be careful with the glory of God. Remember the Ten Commandments? What did He say in the Ten Commandments? Thou shalt have no graven images. And part of that was saying, don't serve any other gods. Don't serve any other images. I'm the only true God. But I believe also part of that was saying, you don't make any images of me. Now, why? Is that unreasonable? What if I had a dream and I just felt in my dream that I saw Christ upon the cross and just felt so close to Him, I could just see what He looked like. So I woke up from the dream and wrote down the image in a painting and I put it up. Why would He not like that? Why would that be against what He wants? Why would He say, don't have any graven images of Me? No images of Me. Why would He do that? Because you see, my friends, it's a great injustice to God to not do justice to who he really is. To give a blurred vision of who God is a great insult to Him. You know, by the way, that's the reason why every minister should absolutely tremble when he walks into the pulpit to speak to God's people. So you see, what I'm doing tonight is I'm painting a picture of Jesus Christ. And it would be a great insult to paint an image of Christ that would distort Him and not show His true beauty and show His true glory. What an insult that would be. But it says of Christ, He is the express and the exact image of the Father. You see, 1 Timothy 6 verse 16 says that He dwells in a light which no man can approach into, whom no man has seen nor can see. He dwells in a light, again, that is unapproachable, that is too glorious, that is too much for human eyes to behold. And yet He says in Colossians chapter 1, in verse 15, that Jesus Christ is the image of the invisible God. He is the exact stamp. He's exactly what God wants you to see about Himself. Well, for time's sake, we won't continue to go through these seven glorious beauties of Christ. But let me just mention to you one more thing about these. After He had purged us from our sins, it says He sat down on the right hand of the Majesty on high. I want to tell you where He is today. He's sitting. He is sitting because He has finished the work that He came to do. But He is also sitting in a position of power as He continues to rule and reign over heaven and over earth. As He brings people to Himself, as He disposes of events throughout the world, He sits on the throne of power. The right hand in Exodus is considered the place of power. But what I really want you to see is, my friends, is what it says on that last phrase, on high. He sits at the right hand of the Majesty on high. That phrase on high is used nowhere else in the Bible. Here's what it means. It means that He is in an elevated position that is the highest position that is possible. But not only that, it's the highest position that is possible or can even be imagined. Okay? I don't have a very good imagination, but I'm sometimes stunned by the imagination of some of the children that I observe on a daily basis. They have an incredible imagination. Come up with all kinds of things. And there are a lot of imaginations that are running wild out through this world. It says here, though, He sits in a place that is so high that no one can even imagine any place that's even any higher than that. My friends, Jesus Christ is superior. Jesus Christ is excellent. Jesus Christ is valuable. Now, quickly, let's talk about earth. Jesus versus creation. Creation meaning just life. Whatever you're enamored with, whatever you enjoy, wherever your allegiance are drawn to, wherever your attention is drawn to on a daily basis more than Christ. And Thou, Lord, verse 10 of Hebrews 1, and Thou, Lord, in the beginning, hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of Thine hands. They shall perish, but Thou remainest. And they all shall wax old as if a garment, and as a vesture shalt Thou fold them up, and they shall be changed. But Thou art the same, and Thy years shall not fail. You know, there's not seven things there, are there? We had to speed through those four just for time's sake tonight. A lot more could be said with a lot better ability than I have. But there's not seven things described about everything in the world that we enjoy so much. It takes our attention away from Jesus Christ. You know what it says about them? Just one thing. It says, like a garment that is old. A favorite shirt that I have. Maybe your job is your favorite shirt.
and you wear that shirt out. You wash it too much and it loses its color. And then you wash it, you wear it too much and it gets holes in it. So what do you do then? You fold it up and you put it in the pile for the rummage sale or the pile for the Salvation Army or the pile for the garbage, depending on its condition. It's folded up. It's gone. It's useless. It's not of any worth or value to you anymore. That's what he says of all of earth, of all of creation, of all of life. You see, my friends, when we compare, it's really rather silly, isn't it? All the things that grab our attention with such focus. We grab hold of it so hard. We stick to it. We spend our good years, our energy, devoting ourselves to it, pursuing it with all of our might, even if it's laziness. We pursue it, we pursue it, we pursue it. What happens? It's folded up, it's cast aside, it's useless and worthless to us anymore. He would say, therefore, seeing this comparison, seeing this silly blowout. I mean, this competition was not a competition at all, was it? It was a stunning defeat, 103-0. Seeing this, he says, we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest at any time we should let them slip. Verse 3 of Hebrews 2, how shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation? If we neglect Christ, if we neglect His Word, if we neglect devoting ourselves to Him, how can we possibly expect to escape? Again, that's a warning. But it's not the warning that drives us necessarily, is it? What drives us, my friends, is beholding Jesus Christ. You must behold Jesus Christ every day of your life. No matter what else you have to give up, you must not give up those quiet times spent pondering Him. You say, I've been trying to read the Bible, and it's just blank to me, it's just boring, it's just, I want to pray, but my times of prayer seem to be just the most frustrating times in the world. Then pray. Lord, give me the heart. Open my eyes, that I may behold wondrous things out of Thy law. Lord, I will not let go. So that I know, God, I know in my heart of hearts, I know what Your Word is, I know that You are valuable, worthy to be had over all. And but God, I'm not seeing You right now. And don't let go. He says, call upon Me and I will answer. I will answer. I'll show you things that you did not know. He will do it. But you've got to stick to it. You've got to say, listen, with the same vehemence, the same desire that I pour forth in everything else, I'm going to pour forth into getting to know Jesus Christ better. You see, our love for Christ is directly related to our knowledge of Christ, to our time spent with Jesus Christ. He is fair to be desired, and He answers those who call, amazing as it is, because He has to condescend to even behold the things that are in heaven. Jesus Christ above all. May God bless you.